communications or what?
Well, it may be in part. It's hard to say. Now, this is the type of thing that we've experienced in weather service. In recent years, even back in the Midwest, where you know they have a greater frequency, their figures have shown the same kind of increase. Of course, since about the late 50s back east, well, it kind of has, you know, run pretty true. I think the figures are probably pretty good. So you could probably call these more recent years being, you know, fairly indicative. In an area out here where they are less prone to occur, you may get more variation, you know, that you would in an area where they're a little more on a regular basis. But even in the areas where they are do occur with greater frequency, well, they have a lot of variation from year to year too. So it's
well, you do or don't feel that they're on the increase then, as far as the Northwest is concerned.
Well, I don't think we have a fair basis of evaluation, really. Because undoubtedly these reports, these things were probably occurring, you know, with pretty fair on some basis of occurrence, or you know, that's somewhat regular. I would think there's going to be, you know, ups and downs in the thing, but from the little bit of data, well, I was just trying to, you know, to draw some detailed conclusions from a small amount of data.
Yeah.
That was to begin with, you've got something that's just doesn't happen that often anyway. Mm-hmm. To get these occurrences, you know, from time to time. The ones that we've experienced, some of the ones recent years, well, you know, it's just happened chance that somebody's been there to see it. And this may be true with a lot of these other occurrences, you know.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is there wasn't the population that there used to be, or the communication either.
Yeah.
And a Vancouver thing could happen down around Eugene, and nobody would know about it 100 years ago.
Well, we do know, though, that this was very likely one of the largest that ever occurred. You
is
know,
that right?
It was most significant, let's say. And the figures really have been put together in Washington. We do have some data from Idaho, and this is much superior to anything that has occurred in Idaho. And from the facts that I've seen in Washington, the occurrence or counts that I've read, you know, I've not run across anything that significant before, so I feel I'm very sure that this is a rather significant occurrence, and probably at all time as far as anything that's ever been recorded. Certainly.
What about some of these others? I haven't really gone into over this. Does this indicate where they were, these other?
Oh, yes. Now, this...
here's the county.
Yeah, again, the county and the communities. There was one here a few years ago. That's the Enterprise. Let's see, that was 8 to 10 miles in length. 800. Now, this shows a bigger path. 30,000 trees damaged.
Oh, yeah.
And 40 million board feet of lumber. Let's see, was that a call from me?
Yeah.
Excuse me a minute. On a most tornado activity, you have three basic ingredients. You have I'll give you some diagrams here so you can kind of get a little closer there, but perhaps a little more technically, and they do have some good diagrams. But basically, you have a warm tongue of moist air coming, feeding into an area.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have coming into this area from an opposite direction for a westerly. Normally, this is kind of a southerly component or a southwesterly component. Here, our warm, moist air would have come up the coast and over the coast ridge. And so by comparison with the air that came in from the west, it was warmer and moister considerably. And then this air that's coming in from the west, which is considerably cooler, well, this in itself creates a lot of instability. Warm air on the bottom, cold air on top, so you get this overturning situation. And tied in with this was the jet stream at intermediate levels, which is one of the three main ingredients for this type of activity. Let me see if that we've got a real good publication if I can come down a copy on this thing that shows. What a very good one. Of course, I just got there too. It would be good background information. We used to have this older piece of material that showed a classic type situation, you know, all that done. Mm-hmm. Which was very good. They're moving into this warm tongue, you know, it created a squall line condition, which includes, you know, a very unstable air mass situation, mm-hmm. where the development of that there can be development of large thunderstorms, and this was apparently the case the other year as well.
Do you think that
this shows one in the Midwest. But basically, you have this warm, moist tongue. You have your warm, dry winds intermediate with the jet stream situation coming in. And basically, cold air coming in at the surface from and these are some materials on tornadoes that traction through.
Oh, okay. Are you giving me this? Or you just have
yes, you may have that.
Do you feel that in this particular situation, the fact that it struck on the north shore, the corner is the river or the open area by the airport, have anything to do with this? Does that sort of a ground situation have anything to do with the
Well, the...
You take like tornado country in the Middle West is open country, largely, and...
Yeah, of course, to begin with, you have to have the right ingredients now, and just when this all gets mixed to the right proportion, you know, wherever this happens to be, it may be that there are local influences or topography or whatever that will accentuate this or diminish the influence of it or whatever, you know, may have some positive or negative action on the actual formation, but... in essence here, you had this system that was developing that as it came over the West Hills, maybe this in itself, you know, they're coming over this barrier and perhaps created greater mixing or something, you know, which...
Well, there was no particular trouble in Portland, was there? There were a few down trees and things.
Yeah, and they seemed to be right along the track of this...
Is that right?
Tornado
act. Now, I know I drove out, we live in North Portland, and where we weren't particularly touched, but I drove out towards 33rd on Ainsworth, and there were several broken limbs and things in that center parking area on Ainsworth,
Here's the building down in Tigard that was damaged, you know, the lumber yard down there. Now, this is over the West Hill. This is right about up in here where I live, and my wife, maybe you heard my comments.
What's that, Northwest Portland?
Yeah, out on Southwest Hamilton.
Oh.
Just off the Beaverton Hillsdale Highway, and But they heard that terrible roar, and we have a young weather observer out there, a kid that's very much interested, and he was telling me about how the clouds were moving, you know, and which indicated, you know, that, well, and then the thing came right across downtown, see, and our barograph trace, we hit just a very typical tornado type of thing. The pressure was decreasing, as you would view it here, and then all of a sudden it took a straight down dip and came up about like this, and which is the type of thing you get when you have a very severe thunderstorm go overhead. And so that there were some pretty good cells within the squall line, and so it's not.
But then that sort of thing happens so fast, there's no real way to predict it very long in advance.
Well, of course, in country where they have a lot of frequencies, they have very good, the Weather Service has very good radar coverage. And here, we don't have this greater frequency with this type of storm.
Oh, but then they travel a lot farther in that tornado country, too.
Well, yeah, those things will go, you know, maybe 20, 30, 50. Some of them have gone over 100 miles, you know, one single, not all the same tornado, but a family of tornadoes. Let's see, that's probably just.
That's right, Washington.
Gives wind. Yeah, that would probably be a good one. That's a good little summary, too. And
did you have something else you needed photocopied?
Oh, we might photograph out the Oregon stuff. Really, you know, some of those storms are really quite significant in Midwest, and but those are rare, too, you know, those exceptional storms there. But this is what you'd really call an exceptional storm, you know, of this nature in this part of the country.
Well, now there was a map in the journal, what I didn't quite understand, which indicated that this thing struck down in the valley a couple of places, too. They indicated on this map. Did you happen to see that map that indicated down around Dallas and Albany that there were either buildings or something went down?
Well, I think they had one map in the paper here which had indications, I think, of, I'm not sure this is the one. That's the map of that Vancouver area. But they had a map in the lower valley here, and it indicated locations where there were wind, electrical outages or, you know, some type of wind damage. And we had scattered wind damage all over the state that day because of the fact of these, you know, high wind conditions. Even on the west side, just before we found out we had it here, I was talking to a guy over in Redmond, a county agent over there, and I could hardly hear him. The phone line was cracking so much, and he said they were having a big windstorm over there, you know, so this was just part of the associated front.
Well, I have been watching the noontime news and Golly Channel 2, and the weatherman, I forget his name, he didn't bother with the young fellow, was warning that there were winds or a storm coming, but of course didn't indicate anything of this nature.
Yeah, well, they had indications at the airport, our Weather Service forecast office there at the airport, and had been in contact with the radar units up at Auburn, Washington, and then they also have a link out here at tied in with Laurel Mountain on the coast region. And then it's also tied in, well, and then they have reports down in the Medford area too on Mount Ashland. So these all gave them some information, but the type of radar that they use, it really isn't designed for weather detection. They use a much narrower radar band type for that. Now they can rework these things and reset them manually so that they can pick up quite a bit of stuff, but I don't know that much about radar to know how good they are, but so it takes some special effort on their part, and they're set up primarily for tracking planes and this type of thing. So here you get cross purposes, and certainly what they provide is a help, but it really doesn't give us the perhaps all the information that we need to really be on top of these things. Because in tornado country, they'll come out with a forecast box area in the morning. You know, we in Kansas City, Missouri, there we have National Severe Storms Forecast Center there, and they, of course, during the season, in fact, year round, they watch all the weather, and when these conditions are right, well, they'll say that there's a box area of which there's 80% chance, or 80% chance of any tornadoes occurring, with that they'll occur within this box area. So then the existing radar weather radars in that area and surrounding areas, you know, is they watch the progress of the weather in that area. So they start seeing a line of thunderstorms form. Well, they watch these very closely, and they of course make periodic reports on the weather circuits to all stations, and then certain stations have warning responsibilities. They see a cell developing near or upwind from this given community. Well, they'll warn the civil defense officials there, and then the local people go into action and put out their tornado spotters. And so that the first sight of a funnel in the clouds, well, then they sound their warning. And this is the type of tight system you have back east. And these things are explained in the materials there. And but here, where we just don't have that kind of frequency, well, it was said, I think, by some of our people at the airport that probably you'll never have a tornado detected, you know, forecast in this kind of area, because basically we don't have the close weather radar surveillance that it takes to do this sort of thing. With the right equipment, you can actually predict, you know, which you can tell in advance prior to the formation of an actual visible funnel, that, you know, that something is very imminent there. And so there is that warning period that's available, but you do have to have the radar capabilities of...
And of course, in this country, if you had the warning, what would you do anyway, really, except get the kids out of buildings, out
well,
of school buildings?
Well, this is it. You could put them in safer places, perhaps. You wouldn't have got them caught on the school grounds, you know, the playgrounds, or in perhaps in big rooms, auditoriums like they were. And
those high school kids sure did a beautiful job, didn't they?
Yeah, I'll tell you, I think everybody over there really came through like a rose.
I haven't driven out there yet, but I was going to do it before the weekend, because I understand there was quite a traffic jam last week.
Yeah, well, of course, I think that is, you know, we were out there Saturday, and it wasn't too bad. We had to wait at a few corners so we could inch our way through the intersection, but they're cleaning up this debris every day, so a lot of the evidence will be gone, but you can still, I tell you, if you want to look at the path, well, when you cross the bridge here, go up the river and take one of the first roads. Actually, past the airport, there's an intersection up there. I can't think what that road goes up the hill.
I'm familiar with that area.
But anyway, and then you first major street that goes along the brink of the hill up there, go down through that neighborhood, and you kind of crisscross. As you go kind of northward through that McLaughlin Heights, and you can see these various houses that have the damage, and that thing ends clear up there in the Brush Prairie area.
Oh, it does.
Yeah.
How far was that? About how far?
Well, that's 9 miles from the north bank of the Columbia. And we understand that there was some additional damage up in the battleground area, but our people never did see any of that. And,
what about the width of it? What did you?
Well, of course, in some places it's maybe, you know, from maybe like 30, 50 yards wide, you know, mm-hmm. where it's just a very small indication, but it at one area there from between the school and that wear mark up there, mm-hmm. where the mm-hmm. which was pretty much the broadest point in the path, there's good indication there that that thing was from a quarter to a third of a mile wide.
Is that right?
And where there were reports of people who actually saw funnels, but with this type of storm, it's very, at least it was reported to us. Now, we were never able to run down any of these people, but with this type of storm, basically, it isn't at a very high altitude off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And so, associated with this thunderstorm, you have this heavy area of heavy rainfall, some hail, and so moving clouds, which tends to obscure perhaps what is going on, you know, in that immediate damage area. So this is where we, you know, really didn't have a fair evaluation perhaps as the actual sighting.
What causes it to kind of skip, where some buildings will be hit and others won't? Is it partly the structure of the building, or is it the wind, pattern of the wind, or what?
It's just the characteristic. You have to realize, of course, that the thunderstorm is producing the tornado itself is in chaos. You know, it's in, it's composed of updrafts and downdrafts, and so there's a lot of physical or mechanics being undertaken there, and so that there's a lot of movement, and just maybe the inflow of air into this thing. See, the thing that feeds this thunderstorm or tornado is this inflow of air from all around.
Yeah.
So maybe you've got a building over here that kind of blocks the air from coming in. Well, maybe this, in essence, might let that thing kind of swing that way. If you don't get anything from there, you've got all this coming in from equal areas, and then all of a sudden you have one sector that maybe there's not much coming in, or it's blocked momentarily, or to some extent. Maybe this make that thing sashay or something, you know. It's just like a whirl in a bathtub, you know. You put your finger down one point, it'll change your characteristic. You put a little wave towards that swirl of water, and it moves, it changes the characteristics of that thing. So this is a lot of things. The atmosphere could do this, you know, just the variability of the wind and the vertical, perhaps, or maybe temperature differences, or groves of trees around, and so.
Now, how the Columbus Day storm was not a tornado at any one place, was it? It was a different type of thing entirely.
Yeah, did she give you a copy of this?
I don't think she gave me that. I'm not sure. She gave me a report on this, on the Columbus Day deal. Maybe this.
I meant for
this big.
No, that's the tornado.
Summary. This is a summary of the Columbus Day.
Oh, okay. Now that, I think that's what this
There's
is.
There's a map in
there. Well, is this, that looks like a different one from this. Let's see,
this
let me look
full,
at that.
Pretty whole summary.
Well, this is one Mr. Stern has prepared here, and this was one by another group of fellows. I'm not that aware.
Well, it was called The Tale of a Typhoon and a Hurricane, part of a hurricane, and a good many things.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if in any if conditions were similar at all between these two, or that created them, or what.
Well, no, the Columbus Day storm was a more massive type thing.
Yeah.
You know, it involved this large low-pressure area that moved in off the coast, and they give the sequence here of the thing and its development, and the tremendous low pressure that was created offshore, and actually the whole thing was up along the shore, and with a stronger center that moved, low pressure moved in along the south coast here, and And let's see, eventually that thing, I guess it went in up on the northern Washington coast, the exact center of that thing, moved in and brought, let's see, this is quite a... You got a pressure difference between large areas, you know, so mm-hmm. that you along a mass front or a mass area, you had, you know, a lot of high pressure rushing into a low pressure area, you know, and to fill that void, and which produced all these southerly extreme winds, which were felt primarily in western Oregon, and to some extent on the east side also, but this gives a very good chronology of the storm, and I think it provides you, you know, details on it, probably much better than I could, since I'm not really that acquainted with the situation. This particular storm last week, now on the 5th of April, was produced from a frontal system coming in, and ahead of this frontal system was, you know, this squall line activity, which moves through. And of course, in all cases, most cases, it's in this squall line area ahead of a cold front, where you have some of the cold air mixing with the warm air, and before the actual cold air gets in there. Once the cold air gets in there, well, this kind of caps the whole thing and put that cold air on the ground, and that eliminates any possibility of tornadic activity.
Well, now, the man on the street, will, myself included, will get the feeling that our weather patterns are changing, or we're having colder and longer cold seasons and things like that. Is there any thing to substantiate that?
I think it's all relative, you know, compared with yesterday or, you know, 100 years ago, and we don't have good measures on, you know.
Well, I read, and my grandfather used to say that the second half of the century was always the colder half. And I read somewhere recently where it will not warm up now until the 90s or something again. Really, it'll go the other way. Is there any truth in that sort of thing? Do we have colder second halves of centuries or not?
Well, in the northern half? Here, for an example, in Portland, you know, we've got records from 1870, you know, and you look at these records from year to year. There's variation from year to year, and you say you've got a cold year. Well, maybe you had quite a few cold months in this year, you know. And the winter maybe was a little more extreme, but there's a lot of... You get into weather cycles, this is a pretty big ball game. And about every researcher can come up with his own weather cycles. And so are you talking in terms of small areas or west coast areas, you know, or western Oregon or eastern Oregon or Washington? And so you look at an individual station record, certainly there's, you know, variation from year to year, and
is there any feeling of pollution, air pollution, or things like that are having their effects? Or
of the researchers have proven their own satisfaction that this is certainly a part of their story. We know with these pollutants that they have their effect on the climate.
Of course, you hear the rumor too that the Chinese dropped another bomb in the air here recently. That might have had something to do with it. Is there anything to substantiate that kind of statement?
I would say not. Really, that's a very small part of the atmosphere. This may throw some debris, you know, into the atmosphere, but. By and large, it's as far as if you're talking about tornadoes or local weather conditions, you know, in essence, they are a result of what's occurring elsewhere around the world, you know, at that particular latitude, perhaps. But yeah, you get into this thing on weather cycle. It's very.
You hear people say too that now at the time of the I lived out in Forest Grove for many years.
Uh-huh.
People claim the weather changed out there after the 1933 Tillamook burn, Tillamook fire.
Yeah, well, this
do big forest fires have their effect that way?
Yes. Anytime you remove a mass green area like this, which is, you know, a conditioner of the air that is passing over, the air in a meaty area is conditioned to some extent by the local conditions. And, this is an example of this, you know, just the area along the coast compared with inland Oregon, you know. To say what degree, well, this may be hard to measure. Maybe one can.
I would never quote you on it, but just thinking, if a forest fire would do it, this clear cutting now, is that going to be, would that have its effects too?
Locally, it certainly would. Depends. And by locally, I would think, you know, people within a few yards, a few hundred yards, or maybe a mile, depending where they are within
the region. But it's strictly a local effect.
Yes. Now, if you take something like the Tillamook burn, of course, this was quite extensive, so the effect would be perhaps a little more extensive. And to say just how extensive, well, this is probably leaves a lot of room for conjecture. So.
You don't really feel, and I'm speaking primarily of the Pacific Northwest, that our weather is particularly changing. It's just one of those years, then, or one of a cycle of a few years. This seems like it's
basically
been an awfully long winter, for instance.
Well, if you look at the records, they show, a cyclic change. Even those annual precipitation figures, you look at those there for Forest Grove, now these will show. They're basically a 12-year cycle, and there are other cycles, you know, too. So in some of these, the valleys and ridges of these cycles aren't all that pronounced, you know, and sometimes they shift a little bit. So, you know, it's nothing regular that you can really pinpoint.
Nobody knows what causes the cycles, then, really.
Well, certainly it's cycles are in part due to the difference of energy received, you know, from the sun, whether this is caused by air pollution or of one sort of another, or the change in the prevailing winds around the world. These, of course, have their cycle. In some periods, these tend to shift. Let's see, what was it? There was a statement that our agency came out with last winter. Don't know if I got a copy of that or not. But anyway, it told about, let me see if I can spot that thing. I can't recall quite the details. Being quoted on the thing, you know, it had to do with, this particular. I can't recall if it was warming or cooling in the east that they've been experiencing for about 10 years due to I think it was a warming over a part of the Pacific, which in essence pushed the storms farther north, you know, so that they, I guess, would get into the Midwest or the far eastern part of the country, in essence creating colder winters there for a period of years. So here, undoubtedly, the warming or cooling of the ocean in certain areas compared to the long-term norm, you know, has some effect on these storm areas that tend to concentrate themselves, you know, part of the globe, you know, for one reason or another. Yeah, this, of course, we don't really get into climatic change that much, so it takes a full-time researcher. Somebody's got a real special interest to get in that sort of thing.
My own ignorance, I'm curious, a climatologist, how do you differ from a meteorologist
Well, the meteorologist, he's primarily concerned with current conditions, the current forecast, and serving these immediate needs of the public, whereas we, at the end of the month, we get copies of all these records that are taken all over the state. These are eventually published in publications, and we use these over the years, have all this back data, and somebody wants to look up a certain storm or... Oh, the Chamber of Commerce told me today they wanted to. They were looking at a date to hold a boat race that they had last year, and they wanted to look at 10 years of June 25th, So we went back in records with them and told them what the temperatures and kind of rainfall and clear conditions that might have existed that given year. And. So you just have all sorts of applications. Maybe some engineer wants data for designing a roof drainage system, or an engineer who wants to design a ponding system for a sewer system, and a water, city water supply, just all kind of. Mm-hmm. Applications that one could make of data.
Hey, on this, I understood on this tornado that one of your men came in from Salt Lake or something to see the damage and everything. What was the object of that?
Well, any time we have a bad storm like this where there are five or more people killed, then mm-hmm. they have to make a special investigation and write up a formal report on it. Any storms where they meet a certain category, they're written up in a publication called Storm Data, which you have a copy of mm-hmm. for that one Columbus Day storm. Uh-huh. And but in addition to that, they of course look into the aspects of compare the actual forecast with the basic data that was received, and mm-hmm. to see what the quality of the actual handling of the circumstance was. So it's just an evaluation of the storm itself too. And this is done for several reasons, of course, for documentation and also to see if there's more emphasis needed, in protecting against this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. This happened right after the that earthquake up in Alaska, mm-hmm. the Weather Service and other agencies were at the point of reforming, and it was shortly after that in they grouped several agencies together, so that their functions would be more coordinated. And then back in the Palm Day series of tornadoes that they had in the Midwest in 1965, April 65, they had a very extensive, they had hundreds of people killed in that thing, and they had very extensive, they came up with a big thick book on this thing,
Is that right?
And so this is when they instrumented their program for intensifying the network mm-hmm. of storm warning radar. And, mm-hmm. So these things occur, our science tends to grow up, I guess, mm-hmm. what we find out. Mm-hmm. Maybe we haven't been doing the job, and we need more help, whether it be electronic or manpower or whatever. But I just found one thing. I noticed Palm Sunday series there in 1965, they realized that most of their stations, when these things occurred and across the wide area like this, they lost all their power.
Yeah.
And so they weren't able to function, continue the radar and so on. So then they provided for auxiliary power for many of these stations, mm-hmm. and so that they could function. So, there's just a lot of aspects that come out of a special report like this. And Mr. Chet Glenn,
Chet Glenn,
I think it's a double N. Let me check here.
What's his title?
Glenn. He's in our Western Region headquarters in Salt Lake City there, and he's the head of public service. C.L. Glenn.
Mm-hmm.
But I went with the people from the airport here. Three others from the airport myself went out on Thursday to make the physical preliminary designation on the thing, mm-hmm. and see what we had. And then once it was officially a tornado, he came down and they went out again, took helicopter rides across the area, took extensive photographs, and which will be taken back and studied in detail. You can see only so much at the time, and so.
Is there such a thing as we used to hear in California with being earthquake weather? But is there such a thing as on things like this tornado and also the Columbus Day storm, a certain kind of appearance to the sky or the atmosphere? Now Columbus Day, they said there was a strange glow in the sky before this thing hit. And I know the week of this tornado, last week I guess it was, my wife got up that morning and looked out the window and she said, gee, that looks funny out there. And this was at 7 o'clock, which was at 6:30, which was several hours earlier before. They said, is there such a thing? Is that kind of a pre-appearance
Well, it'd be a hurricane or a tornado situation. You have certain characteristic weather conditions.
Strange light appearance.
Well,
I don't
know. I think would probably be more individual interpretation, perhaps.
Well, of course, this one woman got a picture, of this, the two pictures. You've probably seen that one with the telephone company got, and then let's see, this other one of a Columbus Day thing, and that was Portland. This woman in the Heights took that.
Let's see.
And the one in the and that was just about an hour or so before.
What direction was that looking?
It's looking out over the city from Portland Heights, I think.
That's from the east, huh? Well, of course, it's coming down between the clouds, and sometimes you get some very eerie.
Sometimes when you're going to have an electrical storm, there'll be a copper color to the sky. There seems to be. What is the cause of that?
A copper color?
Yeah, kind of a bronze or copper color to your sky.
Unless associated with. With many thunderstorms, the large cloud, which is a cumulonimbus cloud, one of the characteristic parts of that is a large overhanging cloud sheath,
mm-hmm.
which is far in advance of the movement of the storm. You know, that thing can hang out there maybe 60, 70, to 100 miles in extreme cases, you know, ahead of a large thunderstorm cloud where it is a large cumulonimbus. And so this self is a thin layer of clouds in essence, and some parts thicker than others back near the main core of the cloud column, but this in itself would provide strange lighting perhaps in an area that was being approached by a storm. So I don't know, I would think it would be pretty hard to say.
What I was really getting at was, is there any way of detecting in advance that way that there might be something going to happen?
Oh, I don't know, not really. Your various cloud types, there's some good examples in here. Let me get your copies separated here so we won't...